Welcome to Just the Taste. I'm Scott Curry with Chef's Best. We gather and talk about the trends in marketing, retail, and production in food and beverage that are shaping the industry. Joining us today is food adventurer Stefan Gates. Stefan is a self-proclaimed gastronaut. He is a television presenter, author, and live show performer. Having written 6 books about extraordinary food and cooking and presented 14 TV series, mostly for the BBC, including Gastronauts and Incredible Edibles, Food Factory, and more. He also works with brands and NGOs to develop eye-catching campaigns and PR-friendly food events. Stefan seeks to make the oftentimes complex topic of food and science more accessible. Ultimately, Stefan is an educator with a unique ability to make science and food fun for all ages. Stefan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
All right, Stefan, what is a gastronaut?
A gastronaut is somebody who explores the hinterland of food, somebody who cares about the stories behind food rather than just flavor and taste and putting some nice food on a plate and manners and making people happy. Actually delves a bit deeper and finds out the kind of murky truth and the science and the religion, the sex and death and the morality and the impact of that lies behind food. So it's very much digging deeper into food, I would say, and exploring what it all means, what it all does, what it could do, how you blow it up, you know, what else can food do? And it's about that sort of exploring and taking food as an adventure. You know, you could go through your life having a wonderful time and just having food as a comfort tool or for fuel, but what a waste it would be, because we spend so much of our time eating or washing up or thinking about food that, you know, I think the stories behind it are fascinating and they tell us huge amounts about our place in the world.
So what led you to this path where, I believe as an English major from Oxford, you are now, you know, dedicated to educating people, particularly youth, about science, food science, chemistry, etc. How did you stumble into this role?
I think it pretty much started with sex, I would say. You know, so I'm at university, I'm absolutely the poorest person in my college. And, you know, you can't take girls out for dinner because it's just cripplingly expensive. And then you realize that if you can cook, then suddenly you're working on a whole different level, and that people are drawn towards you, and that you don't have to spend too much money. So I would go out to the covered market in Oxford and buy the cheapest protein known to man, which was usually either herrings or mackerel or bacon offcuts. And I would take them back and I would work really hard at trying to find out how I could make them edible and delicious and using literally the cheapest food on the planet. And it was very much so that I could kiss girls, I think. That was the early driver. And then I was just fascinated by laying on big spreads. So having my mates around and gathering people around me rather than going to restaurants, but having these adventures, trying things we'd never tried before. And my friends were very happy to be my guinea pigs so that I could experiment on them. And they didn't, you know, I never used to actually serve dinner until at least midnight because I'd been messing about in the kitchen, by which time they were all completely drunk. And then we would explore, and you know what? Probably a quarter of the meals I cooked were a total disaster and inedible. But that's the adventure. That's the adventure that you go on. You try out some, you know, ancient dishes. You try out brand new things, and when you're snuffling around in the alleyways and the byways of food and the hinterland, you do discover some real gems and some awful terrible. You kiss some terrible frogs along the way as well. And then as I got older, I was working in TV. I was a TV producer working in comedy, but all the time, all I ever really cared about was food. And so we'd make these comedy programs, which were just awful because I never used to read the scripts. All I cared about was where the crew was going to eat. And so we would go out with these awful scripts that never really worked. But we'd have a fantastic time and we'd explore. And I just started writing. I was writing scripts at the time, writing film scripts. And then one day I just got so fed up with the kind of wet, wimpy food writing that was in the magazines in Britain at the time. I remember throwing a magazine across the room and just thinking, well, if I really think that that's that rubbish, then maybe I should write my own material. And so I started writing. I thought I'd write the anti-food piece, the anti-recipe, which was how to cook and serve your child's guinea pig at the table. And it was supposed to be a bit of fun, and it was exploring sort of ideas of morality and food and what we see as food and what we see as pets, and why is one animal one thing and why is one another. But there was this bolt of lightning that hit me that just said, this is something so exciting that even though I'm writing it as a joke and it's a silly thing, food has these layers of story and impact and embarrassment and shock and emotion, and that this is what I've been dealing with all of my life, and I'd never really discovered it properly. So I started writing a book, which is my first book, called Gastronaut. And it was about the weird, the grubby, the unsavory, the unpalatable. It was about cannibalism. It was about Holy Communion. It was about the worst recipes on the planet and the best. And just about getting food that flaps your trousers a little bit and makes you realize that you're alive. And we cooked things like head cheese, which is taking a whole pig's head and you simmer it for about 4 or 5 hours, and then you pick off anything that's edible from it and you make it into this big pate. And you realize that a lot of these little journeys, these recipes, are little stories of guilt and redemption, and that they become something with such a greater impact than just serving you food. And then there's the history behind these things and the revulsion in a lot of stories as well. And I think that's where the fascination lies for me, is in what makes something delicious, what makes something appealing, and what makes something revolting, and at what point do you draw a line there? And then I quickly started mucking about with a lot of chemists. One of my best friends is a professor of chemistry at UCL, and we just started cooking, and we made the most extraordinary foods: glowing jellies, jelly vortices. Lots of explosions using food, and you just discover that food, cooking is chemistry, digestion is biology, and you stick something into a pan and that's all about the physics. And so food is steeped in all of these wonderful, wonderful, wonderful subjects, and especially science, and it's endlessly fascinating. And that's become my world, really. I spend a lot of my time explaining science through food rather than explaining food through science.
That was very introspective. I was afraid maybe we were going off the rails with alcohol and food. But that was going to ask you about mindful eating, because I probably eat mindfully about one every 30 meals, I would say. Perhaps.
And what do you mean by mindful eating?
Being aware and present with the food that you're eating, appreciating the taste, chewing slowly, even completing the mind-body connection where you're, thinking about the food, as it's starting the digestive process. The opposite of mindful eating being a typical dinner at my household, where I'm shoving, trying to get 1,000 calories of whatever down my mouth as quick as possible. And, my wife and I find that, I've got two kids and the whole thing, but my wife and I find that we do go out on a dinner date together. We try to inhale our food because we've kind of programmed herself. Meanwhile, there's a $35 perfectly prepared halibut in front of us, and we're just woofing it down and not tasting it. Yet it seems that you're kind of an advocate of a little bit of the opposite, which is just perhaps thinking about where the food came from, thinking about where how it was prepared, and identifying the subtleties and the taste to it, and just a deeper appreciation, which I find it's very hard to do these days. Yet I'm compelled to somehow remind myself to do that a little bit more, as opposed to, it's just a race for calories, and then you you forget that what you're consuming has everything you mentioned, a story behind it, and you know how it will or will not nourish your body and everything.
Yeah. So I've just finished the first draft of my new book, which is called Fartology, and it's the science of your portable chemistry lab. And it is extraordinary, actually, the fascinating part of food, well, certainly half of the fascinating part of food, really happens after you've finished tasting it, and it starts moving down into your guts. And it is an extraordinary, extraordinary journey. I had a gastroscopy for a show that I did a couple of months ago, and following the journey down just takes you into a totally different world. It's a strange, it's almost distasteful, almost like it's a weird version of pornography. You know, you're wandering inside your body and looking at these things that never normally get seen by the public, and then showing those to audiences of sort of 2,000 people at a time. It's a really strange affair, but that's where the magic begins, and following the digestive process and playing with enzymes. A lot of my work is trying to get people to visualize these things. So I do a huge amount of very large scale live stage shows, trying to show how these things happen, like digestion, which are notoriously internal and you can't really see them. So we spend a huge amount of time working on demonstrations to show these things. So for instance, you can do an amazing thing with the enzymes in your saliva by creating two pots of custard and collecting a bit of saliva from several different people, and they spit into one jar. And their saliva, the enzyme amylase in your saliva, starts to break down the long chain molecules in custard. And within about 10, 15 seconds, the custard turns to water, whereas the custard, your control custard, stays really thick and gloopy. And then you can play with acid, so you can get some hydrochloric acid out, which is the acid in your gastric juices. And if you crack an egg into the hydrochloric acid at the same strength as your gastric juices, you can see that the egg cooks, the proteins in the egg denature just as though you'd put them into a frying pan. And these things, it's when you give these things visual references that it becomes much easier to visualize what's going on. It's a similar thing to dropping some milk into a jar and adding a little bit of vinegar. And that's the same thing that happens in your stomach. That curdling is what happens to the milk when it hits your gastric juices. And it's the first stage of cheese making as well. But I think you have to have very visual things like this. And this is one of the big problems with teaching people about food, and especially teaching children about food. We use terms like energy and calories and burning calories and things like this, which until you burn something in front of them, they haven't got a clue what you're talking about. It's all hypothetical. They can't feel it in their bones. And so I end up taking thermal imaging cameras and showing them their heat imprint, measuring them inside, showing them all these different processes that are happening inside them as well. But also you can blow up lots of food. So if you blow, just before I went to France about 4 days ago, my assistant and I just went through the cupboards in my kitchen looking for different powders that we could blow up. And you blow them across a flamethrower and you see this huge fireball being created. And that's the energy in food. And you can measure it, because if it's 2 teaspoons of icing sugar, of fine powder sugar, then you know exactly how many calories of food energy there are in there. And then you can visualize these things. But until you give people the tools to really visualize them, I think it's quite difficult. You can have your mindfulness where you just sit and have a bit of contemplation, which is fantastic. But if you really want to visualize the process, if you want to take yourself on that journey that your food is going on, you do need to come up with these extraordinary visual connections. And that's what I spend a lot of my life doing, using imaging tools, sticking cameras where the sun don't shine, and recreating what happens inside the body using chemicals or acids and enzymes. I'll get a 10 meter section of guts out and put a bolus of food through it on stage. And then suddenly everyone seems to get it and it's a little bit easier to do. But yes, I wish people did a little bit more of that. But, you know, I'm sitting here with a big plate of cheese and salad to nibble on as I chat to you. I'm not thinking about it. So you can't do it every single meal.
right. I appreciate how you kind of answered one of my questions, which was going to be, you know, why do we not know these things? I mean, it's so important to our body and our existence. And I think the simple answer is probably, you know, it's just we tend to simplify things, right? Calories, energy, maybe you get to the depth of carbohydrates and proteins. But if you know, the adage tip of the iceberg were ever true, I think it is here. I want to ask you, I'm going to throw a potential curveball to you here, I guess, which is given this kind of evolved thinking that you're bringing to food, we've talked a lot about biology and chemistry internally. What is your insight that you could share regarding taste? And what do we not know about taste? That's obviously important because it's the first thing. And even when I am even when I'm just woofing down food, I still take that half second to go, oh, this is good, or this is bad, which is not a good way to describe taste by any means. But, you know, at least allows you to point the finger if someone didn't do well cooking. So how would you, you know, kind of said apply this reflective in deeper thinking to taste? That's a big broad question.
It's a brilliant question as well. So how do we care more, I guess? I think there are a few tools that you can use in this area. Well, what I do a lot of is dyeing tongues blue. So before a meal, and we'll often do this at home, if a bunch of mates come over and I've cooked them a big meal and they're over for a big night out, we'll get some blue food dye out, and you get a little cotton bud and you dip it in the blue food dye and you paint people's tongues blue. And then you look at each other's tongues, and the blue food dye is really interesting because it sticks to the mechanoreceptors and the various different tools that you have on your tongue, but it doesn't really stick very well to your taste buds, and each of your taste buds has about 300 or 400 different taste receptors on. And so you can look at your taste buds, and you can share a little mirror, you know, a little makeup mirror to have a look at it as well. And everyone has a very different tongue. And you can spot the taste buds. You can find out people who have more taste buds than others. And you can also try these little things out called PTC tasting strips. And this is a chemical called phenylthiocarbamide. And it judges, it gives you an indication of whether or not you're a super taster. And they're little tricks and games, and it's maybe not the sort of thing that everyone would have in their house, but they're actually incredibly cheap and great to lay your hands on. And once you understand your own taste sensations, you can begin to judge how people's perceptions of different foods will change. You can use control strips, which are just simple paper strips. And there are a few, there's things like sodium benzoate strips, which everyone tastes very differently. So literally, it's a tiny little piece of paper. You may taste it as being sweet. I might taste it as being salty. And it's only then that you start to pull apart taste and how it works. And then from that stage on, I think it's very much about playing with your food. Now, I don't know if you have this problem in the US that we do in the UK, but the idea of playing with your food is seen as morally distasteful. It's wrong. The idea that you're mucking about with it, that you're exploring it, is seen as unnecessary, as flippant, as wasteful. And I'm not talking about throwing food around, in a food fight, but just exploring ideas with it. And you do get, I think, you get two wildly different types of people who say you shouldn't experiment with taste and things like that because we have fantastic food. Michael Pollan says, you know, don't eat anything your grandmother didn't eat. But my grandmother didn't have garlic. You know, she didn't have olive oil. Does that mean I shouldn't have it? And when you experiment, you come up with new foods and you discover new foods that are really important to the world. So chocolate, for instance, the taste sensations of chocolate from the cocoa pod were revolting for the first few hundred years. It was mixed with chili, and they made a sort of a drink which was a bit of a slurry with fat on the top. And people carried on experimenting with it and trying it out and fiddling with it and trying out different technological processes and tasting it again and again until it became something that is probably one of the finest substances on the planet. And you have to explore and you have to play. And I think the big problem, certainly in the UK, is that we are scared of playing. We're scared of waste, which is understandable, but we're also scared of trying things out. It's seen as sort of silly neophilia to experiment. And I think we have to explore. We still need to find a way to feed a hungry world. And so exploring new flavors, exploring new tastes, taking risks with things is immensely important. And back to the whole idea of how to taste better, I think when you start understanding that it's a multi-sensory experience, you can sit back from it and enjoy the experience so much more. So that's when game playing really comes into it. So there's a famous chef in the UK called Heston Blumenthal, and he plays a lot of games with his food. So like Ferran Adrià, lots of spumas and poaching in liquid nitrogen, caviars made from alginates and things like this. And on one level, you can call it frippery and you can say it's nonsense. Why are people bothering? You know, we have great food. Just cook some good, honest food. Well, if you don't experiment, then you're not gonna cross over these lines and experience something new. And I love Heston Blumenthal's cooking, and I think we should play. But it does take a lot. It takes a lot to push yourself into doing it. But it's the same thing, you know. When you're a kid, you know, you're a neophobe. You know, you don't want to try new things out. Usually, you'll get the odd kid who's really bold and who will try new things. But generally, children are reluctant to try things out, which is, you know, it's a decent evolutionary process to avoid trying things. When you know there's something that will sustain you, stick with it because you won't poison yourself. But yeah, if we're going to solve the world's food problems, we've got to explore and we've got to play, and that means trying out tastes that maybe seem unpalatable. And my last book actually was a book of edible insects, and I made a documentary for BBC4 called "Can Eating Insects Save the World?" And there you are faced with some extraordinary taste sensations. And it's not just the taste on your tongue, which is frankly only five components: salty, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami. It's about revulsion. It's about a primal fear of different creatures. And all of these things actually bind together into the experience of taste or flavor. The sight of these things, the familiarity that you have with them. And it's only when we can really bind all of those different tools together that we can, I believe, really fly and really, really feel like you're having an excitement along the lines of climbing a mountain. And that's what makes life worth living for me.
It's fascinating stuff. I want to ask you a little bit about, another aspect of how you reach out to folks, which, who are some of the food brands that you've worked with to help them broadcast their message in a compelling way? I know that you've had a lot of fun in that arena as well.
Yeah, so I do a lot of work with big food companies who are actually usually conglomerates, and I tend to go in and I don't look at one product, and I don't look at one brand. I do kind of brainstorming sessions with people just to try and get them to slip their skin and to think again about what food can do. So we'll tear apart acid-based reactions, and we'll make carbon dioxide rockets using bicarbonate soda and lemon juice, and we'll make naked eggs by dissolving them. We'll play with the anthocyanins in red cabbage and things like that. And it goes back to this idea of playing. It's getting people to stop exploring. So, you know, a lot of in food companies, a lot of what people are after is a way of shaving a bit of cash or something, or applying a new product to the latest trend that's been identified by whoever it is that's leading their new product development, rather than just slipping their skin and starting afresh and coming up with something really exciting. And so we do a lot of workshops where people, they kind of become kids again, and they get the fascination of how food works and the mess of it, and, you know, sticking your hand up a chicken and tearing things apart and frying some bones up and just trying to think again from scratch about what food is and what it means. And so that's the sort of thing that I do. It sounds very silly. It sounds sort of childish, but it is about game playing and going back to remembering what it is that you love about food. What is it that you enjoy? What is it that makes you feel exhilarated about the food that you eat? And that's the sort of stuff that we do. Whether or not they can go away from that session and come up with a product that is worthy of actually selling in a shop is another matter. It's quite conceptual stuff. But it's a good way of shaking people down and starting again.
Well, you've certainly kind of pushed ahead, if you will, beyond my comfort zone in thinking about food. It's interesting. I'm compelled to maybe grab a few of your books here. I want to point people to gastronaut.com to do that. It's spelled how you would imagine it would, the gastronaut. So the GASTRONAUT.com. And you can find your books on there. I assume these are available in the States as well. I only see pricing in pounds, but
yes, there's a few of my books are
on Amazon or whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also a YouTube channel with lots and lots of demos, mainly aimed at families, to be honest, with kids. So it's the sort of thing that you might do yourself at home. Well, I mean, there's some quite complex chemistry experiments there, but there's also lots of things about just the quirkiness of food, about getting people to think about food again and enjoy it and live it and make food exciting and exhilarating.
Right. And you've got a lot of fun content on there. There's just a couple questions here. One is, why don't we drink pig's milk? I need to read that. you've got a post about how to cook salmon in a dishwasher. Mm-hmm. I'm imagining that involves steaming or something, but we don't have to get into that. And then what we won't get into right now is a blog that you wrote for the BBC about aphrodisiacs, which brings us full circle to sex, alcohol, guinea pigs, and food, where we started. And this has been a journey, as expected. When you're talking with the gastronaut, we went all, I don't know what it was there, phenyl, plinyl, carbonide, or something like that.
nearly, pretty good.
A full circle journey around the food universe. So I want to thank you for being on the podcast and encourage you to get over here to the States because, yeah, we you know, we have our, I would say, Puritan values applied to food a little bit in digestion, and there's certainly some hesitancy and taboos there to talk about certain things that I gather the Europeans are perhaps a little bit more open about. But I think we'd all be served a little bit better and perhaps eat healthier and enrich our lives a little bit more with a little bit more of what you bring to the table. So, when you get over to the States, let us know and we'll make sure that folks we know are aware of it.
That would be a massive pleasure. I love coming up to the States and I love the passion that people have for their own local foods in the States. It makes me proud to be over there. It's fantastic. It's a great place to be.
Super. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Stefan, and keep having fun. I don't think that's going to be a problem. providing this cool, I guess you could call it a public service of getting us to think a little bit differently. So I appreciate you doing that for me.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Take care, Stefan. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on Just a Taste, a Chef's Best Production. Join us again next time as we talk to more experts in marketing, retail, and production in the food and beverage industry. You can always visit us at chefsbest.com to learn more.